They were told the money was safe, not exciting, not risky, just steady, international, protected. The pitch sounded calm. Paperwork was clean. Returns were described as modest and reliable. People signed because the language felt professional, and the referrals came from someone they trusted. Over 8 years, the network grew quietly. Funds moved across borders, statements arrived on time, questions were answered with confidence. No alarms, no pressure, just reassurance. Then payments slowed, excuses appeared, a missed transfer here, a delayed report there. What looked like a stable investment began to feel thin. Banks flagged movements that did not match the promises. Regulators noticed gaps that could not be explained by market swings. Victims compared notes for the first time and realized they were not alone. By the time investigators traced the flows, roughly $18 million had vanished. Four men stood at the center of it. What had been sold as protection was the trap. Chapter 1, the promise of safety. The pitch never rushed anyone. That was part of its power. It arrived calmly, usually through someone the listener already trusted. A colleague, a family friend, a church acquaintance, someone who spoke softly about opportunity but emphasized restraint. This was not about getting rich fast, it was about protection. The network described itself as international. That word carried weight. It suggested diversification and distance from local shocks. Investors were told their money would be spread across stable instruments and overseas vehicles designed to reduce exposure. Risk was described as minimal. Volatility was described as managed. Loss was described as unlikely. The materials looked clean. The language sounded professional. Charts showed gentle upward curves. Returns were modest by design. Nothing flashy. Nothing that would trigger suspicion in someone who had lived through market crashes or seen friends lose everything chasing hype. People listened because it felt reasonable. The men behind the network spoke in careful terms. They avoided absolutes. They talked about safeguards. They talked about structure. They talked about experience. When asked direct questions about risk, the answers came back measured and reassuring. Every investment had some exposure, they said, but this model was built to limit it. What mattered most was tone. There was no pressure to act quickly, no ticking clock, no threat of missing out. Prospective investors were told to take their time. Review the documents, ask questions, talk it over with family. That patience created trust. The network's reach extended across borders. Victims would later be identified in multiple countries, though at the beginning, no one saw themselves as victims. They saw themselves as participants in something conservative and well-planned. Money moved from personal accounts into pooled structures. Transfers were explained clearly. Receipts were issued. Statements followed. For the first stretch of time, everything appeared to work. Investors received updates that confirmed what they had been promised: small gains, stable performance, explanations tied to international markets and currency positioning. Even when returns were flat, that result was framed as a success. Flat meant protected. Flat meant the safeguards were doing their job. Silence also played a role. There were no constant emails, no aggressive calls. Months could pass with only a routine statement. That absence of noise reinforced the idea that nothing was wrong. Quiet meant stability. The network leaned heavily on the idea of safety. That word appeared again and again, sometimes directly, sometimes implied. Safe from market swings, safe from domestic instability, safe because of experience, safe because of structure. Over time, more people joined. Referrals mattered. A satisfied investor carried more weight than any brochure. When someone said they had been in for years and never had a problem, others listened. Trust stacked on trust. Money accumulated slowly. No single deposit raised concern. No single investor felt exposed. The totals only became significant when viewed together, something no individual participant could see. The men running the operation maintained distance. They were visible enough to reassure, but not so present that they invited scrutiny. Communication flowed through set channels. Questions were answered, but always within the frame of the original promise. The language never changed. Conservative, international, protected. As years passed, the network aged into normalcy. It became part of household planning. Some investors reinvested returns. Others added funds when they had extra cash. Life events came and went. The investment stayed put, quietly in the background. This longevity became proof in itself. 8 years is a long time for a fraud to remain hidden, but at this stage, no one thought in those terms. Longevity meant legitimacy. If something were wrong, people reasoned, it would have surfaced by now. The structure discouraged panic. Withdrawals were possible, but not instant. Processing times were explained as part of the international nature of the investments. Delays were framed as administrative, not alarming. Investors accepted this because the explanation fit the story they had already accepted. Nothing felt urgent, nothing felt unstable. The network's internal roles were not public, but the outward presentation suggested order. Each man appeared to handle a specific function. One spoke more, another handled documentation, another dealt with logistics. This division of labor reinforced the image of a professional operation rather than a loose arrangement. At this point, no law enforcement agency was involved. No regulator had stepped in. No public warnings existed. The scheme moved beneath the threshold of attention, not because it was invisible, but because it looked ordinary. That ordinariness was the disguise. The investors believed they were doing the responsible thing. They believed they had avoided reckless bets. They believed they had chosen caution over greed. That belief shaped how they interpreted every interaction. When minor issues appeared, they were absorbed without resistance. A delayed statement could be explained. A slow response could be attributed to time zones. A missed update could be chalked up to workload. Each explanation leaned on the same foundation: international complexity, safety through patience. The network relied on that patience. By the time any individual investor might have considered raising a serious concern, they often looked around and saw no one else doing so. Isolation prevented comparison. No one knew the full scope. No one knew how many others were involved. Each person thought their experience was singular. The men at the center continued to speak with confidence. They did not overpromise. They did not escalate claims. They stayed within the boundaries that had worked from the beginning. That consistency kept doubts quiet. What no investor could see was where the risk truly lived. It was not in foreign markets or currency fluctuations. It was not in geopolitical shifts or economic cycles. It was concentrated in control. Who held the money? Who decided where it went? Who could move it without immediate detection? Those questions remained unasked, not because investors were careless, but because the system was built to make those questions feel unnecessary. At the end of this phase, nothing had collapsed. No alarms had sounded. The network was intact. The money appeared to be working. Trust remained high. The danger was already present, but it was silent. Chapter 2, the cracks in the structure. The first signs did not look like a collapse. They looked like paperwork problems. An investor asked about a transfer that had not arrived when expected. The explanation came back measured and technical: a processing delay, a compliance review, international clearing times. The language was familiar and reassuring. It fit the story everyone already believed. A second delay followed months later, then a third. Each one came with a different reason, but the tone never changed. Calm, confident, controlled. At the same time, banks began to notice movement that did not align with the stated purpose of the accounts. Funds entered pooled structures and left in patterns that did not match conservative investment activity. Transfers moved through layers. Some destinations did not resemble regulated investment vehicles at all. Those observations did not trigger immediate action. Financial institutions flag irregularities quietly. They document, they monitor, they wait for patterns. The pattern emerged slowly. Across borders, small groups of investors began to compare experiences. This did not happen through formal channels. It happened through personal conversations. Someone mentioned a delay. Someone else admitted the same thing had happened to them. The realization was subtle at first, then unsettling. What felt isolated no longer was. Regulatory bodies received complaints that on their own did not appear urgent. A delayed withdrawal, confusing documentation, inconsistent explanations. None of it proved fraud. But when viewed together, the complaints described the same structure, the same promises, and the same four names. Financial analysts started tracing money flows. They followed the path from investor deposits to their supposed destinations. What they found did not match the marketing claims. Funds that were described as internationally diversified were not consistently invested in identifiable instruments. Some money circulated between internal accounts. Some was redirected to personal or unrelated entities. Some moved in ways that obscured its final use. This was the point where suspicion hardened into concern. Investigators faced an immediate challenge: poor management and fraud can look similar at the surface. Losses can occur without criminal intent. Markets can turn. Strategies can fail. To move forward, authorities needed to show that the misrepresentations were deliberate. The four men at the center of the network did not panic. Outwardly, nothing changed. Communications continued. Statements were issued. Explanations stayed within the same framework that had worked for years. Privately, pressure increased. Requests for documentation grew more specific. Regulators asked for proof of investment placements. Banks requested clarification on transfer purposes. Timeframes tightened. The tolerance that comes with ambiguity began to fade. Internally, roles became clearer to investigators. Records showed who authorized transfers. Communications revealed who crafted the messaging. Account access logs identified who controlled movement. Each piece of data narrowed the field. The international nature of the scheme complicated enforcement. Jurisdiction mattered. Different countries had different thresholds and timelines. Coordination required formal requests and patient collaboration. That delay worked in the network's favor, at least temporarily. Money continued to move. Some victims attempted to withdraw funds entirely. Those requests met resistance. Processing periods extended. Additional documentation was requested. New conditions appeared that had not been emphasized before. Each obstacle was explained as necessary. Each explanation bought time. For some investors, fear replaced trust. For others, denial took hold. They had believed in the system for years. Accepting that it might be false meant accepting loss, and that was harder than waiting. The investigation gained momentum when analysts compared promised returns with actual financial activity. The gap was not a matter of underperformance. It was structural. The returns could not have been generated in the way described. This finding shifted the case. Authorities documented communications in which safety was emphasized while internal transfers told a different story. The language used to reassure investors was compared with the actions taken behind the scenes. The contrast mattered. At this stage, the scheme was no longer viewed as a series of mistakes. It was viewed as a constructed narrative. Each of the four men occupied a distinct position within that narrative. One handled external relationships and trust building. Another managed documentation and reporting. Another oversaw movement of funds. Another coordinated across entities. None of these roles existed in isolation. Together, they formed the mechanism. Investigators moved carefully. Premature action could scatter assets and complicate recovery. The goal was not only accountability, but clarity. They needed to show how the system worked from pitch to payout to diversion. As scrutiny intensified, the network's language grew more defensive. Updates referenced regulatory reviews. Assurances leaned more heavily on compliance. The calm remained, but it was strained. Behind the scenes, accounts were examined in detail. Timelines were built. Each transfer was placed in sequence. The longer view revealed something individual investors never saw. The scheme did not rely on growth alone. It relied on control and opacity. By the end of this phase, the illusion had weakened beyond repair. Victims understood that delays were not temporary. Regulators understood that misrepresentation was central. Investigators understood who needed to be held responsible. The countdown had begun. The question was no longer whether the structure was flawed. It was whether the evidence would be enough to prove it in court before the remaining money disappeared. Chapter 3, The Verdict and the Cost. The charges did not arrive all at once. They came after months of coordination, review, and verification. By the time formal filings were prepared, investigators had mapped the network from first pitch to final transfer. The structure that once appeared conservative and orderly now read as deliberate and misleading. Prosecutors laid out the case in plain terms. The investments marketed as safe were never positioned as described. Funds were pooled under the promise of international diversification, then redirected in ways that served the operators rather than the investors. The language of protection had been used as a tool. In court, the timeline mattered. 8 years of activity showed consistency, not accident. The same claims repeated, the same explanations recycled, the same control maintained by the same four men. This was not a single failure. It was a sustained pattern. Evidence focused on contrast. Marketing materials were placed beside bank records. Reassuring emails were read alongside transfer authorizations. What investors were told was compared directly with what the money actually did. The gap was clear and persistent. defense arguments centered on complexity and intent. International finance is complicated, they said. Markets shift, strategies evolve. Not every loss is criminal. Those points were acknowledged, but tested against the evidence. Complexity does not explain false assurances. Evolution does not explain concealed movement. Witnesses described how they had been recruited. They spoke about trust and patience. They explained why they did not question delays earlier. Their testimony was not emotional. It was factual. It showed how ordinary caution had been turned against them. Financial experts detailed the mechanics. They explained why the promised returns could not have been generated within the described framework. They showed how internal transfers masked the absence of real investment activity. Their language was technical, but direct. The court established total losses at approximately $18 million. That figure represented combined investments across multiple countries. It did not account for opportunity cost or personal hardship. It was the measurable damage. Each defendant's role was addressed individually. Authority was traced through access and decision-making. Control mattered more than titles. Those who authorized movement and crafted messaging were held responsible for the outcome. The verdicts followed. All four men were convicted. Sentencing reflected the scale and duration of the scheme. The court acknowledged the planning involved and the number of victims affected. Punishment was framed not only as retribution, but as deterrence. For the victims, the conclusion brought mixed relief. Accountability mattered. Recognition mattered. But recovery was limited. Much of the money had been spent, moved, or otherwise rendered unreachable. Restitution could not make them whole. Statements from victims focused on trust. Many spoke about how the promise of safety had shaped their decisions. They did not describe greed. They described responsibility, saving for family, protecting retirement, planning for stability. The aftermath extended beyond the courtroom. Regulators reviewed oversight gaps. Banks adjusted monitoring thresholds. Warnings were issued to the public about schemes that emphasized safety over transparency. The language of protection became a red flag rather than reassurance. The case left a clear lesson. Fraud does not always announce itself with urgency or spectacle. Sometimes it arrives quietly, wrapped in caution and patience. Sometimes the most dangerous promise is the one that claims there is no danger at all. When the proceedings ended, the network ceased to exist, its structure dismantled, its operators removed, its narrative exposed. What remained was the cost, financial loss that could not be fully recovered, confidence that would take years to rebuild, and a record that showed how easily stability can be mimicked. The final line of the case did not come from a judge or a prosecutor. It came from the evidence itself. Safety was never the product. It was the disguise.